This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up later, we'll follow up our recent conversation about campus sexual assault with a legislative update from State Representative Roberta Willis. But first, climate change is back in the news, in part because of an all-night filibuster by Democratic senators who were trying to get it back in the news, in part because of a Gallup poll that shows Americans really aren't all that concerned about climate change. Today, the American Association for the Advancement of Science will release a new report with scary language like this: temperatures are going up, springs are arriving earlier, ice sheets are melting, sea level is rising. There's more in today's New York Times. So what to do about a problem that science says is getting worse, while public opinion is basically split on whether it's happening at all? Today, a climate change check-in with Gary Yeo of Wesleyan University and Anthony Leiserwitz of Yale. And we'll want you to join the conversation, too. But first, let's meet someone who's trying to change people's minds about climate change. Back in December, 19-year-old Parker Liotto wowed the world. Following an 18-day trek across Antarctica, the Yale University sophomore became not only the youngest male to ski to the South Pole, but also the fastest. But record-setting was just part of the mission. The Willis Resilience Expedition, Parker's 640-kilometer journey, gathered scientific data and piloted a new weather station to develop a better understanding of global warming's effects. We talked to him yesterday. Parker is being honored at the White House today. We talked about some of the broader implications of his climate change research. Parker Liotto, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, maybe you can describe the expedition that you did in late 2013. Why did you do it, and what were you hoping to accomplish?
Well, this expedition was the Willis Resilience Expedition, and we had a couple of main goals. The first was to contribute to a better understanding of the climate system, which is really a very vague way of saying that we had three climate research programs, each one addressing a specific research goal in the climate system. And then the second objective of the expedition was to engage people around the world in sort of a better understanding of how climate change is impacting communities really on a human level around the world. And what we did was we crossed the entire continent from coast to coast in a custom-built truck that we used for as our scientific support vehicle. And then me and my teammate Doug Staup, who is an American polar explorer, we separated from the truck on the other coast and walked 350 miles from that coast to the South Pole in an attempt to break the record for the fastest ski trek from the coast of Antarctica to the South Pole.
And why were you trying to do it so fast? What was behind that?
Well, the speed record is really a mechanism for engaging people in this goal, and we were able to really engage people around the world through the tracking mechanism on our website and through the TV show that we built with a studio in London, where we invited guests and experts on various perspectives of that had various perspectives on climate change, from business to science to policy, to explain kind of the impacts that were being had. But it's also not only just sort of a metaphor for the urgency of action at the moment, but also kind of a reminder that we need to be engaging in very ambitious goals if we're to confront the challenge of climate change very seriously.
Obviously, from what you just said, it sounds as though you don't believe we're taking this urgently enough. Give me a little bit more about what you think not only Americans, but global citizens need to be more urgently thinking about when it comes to climate change.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I am deeply inspired by the way that the Obama administration has actually been attempting to tackle this issue, especially through recent initiatives with the President's Climate Action Plan and the work of the EPA and the Department of the Interior. But obviously more can be done, always more can be done. And at the same time, I feel like American citizens in particular, and also citizens from around the world, can have a big impact by not doing a whole lot differently in their daily lives, but just talking about the issue. Americans don't tend to talk very much about climate change on a daily basis. And one way to have a really big impact is to just talk to your friends and family and colleagues and coworkers and peers, and make a real effort to learn about how these changes are impacting communities through, for instance, more severe extreme weather and the possibility for flooding and sea level rise, for instance. These are, you know, wildfires, for instance, droughts, hurricanes, and flooding are some of the most important impacts that the United States will have to face in the future. And this is just the U.S. There's a whole host of other problems that the world needs to address that are specifically important to individual families and individual people. And so I think that if we were to make more of an effort collectively just to be aware and to talk about it, then the result will be that people are going to be more likely to prioritize these challenges when voting and making action on climate change an important part of how they vote for candidates.
Are you surprised at all that Americans in the years that follow Al Gore's famous movie and the Nobel Prize that accompanied it and all of the policy changes that came about because of climate change, that it seems as though, Parker, American public opinion is going in the opposite direction? We almost care less and less about climate change all the time.
Right, and some of the numbers that come out of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication very recently, I think in November of last year, suggested that only 47% of Americans actually agree that global warming is a man-made phenomenon. And I guess to answer your question, I'm not hugely surprised because there is a lot of there's a tendency in the United States to see this as a sort of debate of opinion, which is really open to debate for the general public to decide whether or not it's something that's real. And I think at the same time, because global warming and all of the complex science that it encompasses is largely compared to personal everyday life, it seems largely abstract and statistical. And it's very hard to pinpoint a specific event and say this is entirely the fault of global warming. Because even when you have a devastating hurricane or a devastating drought, you can't say that it's entirely because of climate change, even though it may have contributed. And so I think a big part of transforming American public opinion is clear communication of the science in a way that is really understandable and actionable, rather than trying to take an obscure scientific issue and really drill it down into the American public as it had done sometimes in the past. And especially I think when it comes to groups that have interest in promoting certain opinions. So I think it's one of the priorities needs to be ensuring the accurate communication of scientific information in sort of novel ways without compromising the integrity of the science that we're communicating.
We're talking with Parker Liotto, who's a 19-year-old polar explorer, a climate change campaigner, a Yale University student. His recent project is the Willis Resilience Expedition 2013. He became the youngest man to ski to the South Pole, and this is where we live. I'm wondering, could you describe what Antarctica is like?
Absolutely. So Antarctica, first of all, is enormous. I mean, it's bigger than China and India combined, and it's the highest, as the saying goes, the highest, driest, windiest, coldest continent on Earth. And when we started our trek, we were almost at sea level. We were at the boundary of the coast, the sort of land boundary with the ice shelf. But we rose to about 9,200 feet, which is where the South Pole is. So it's very high as well. Temperatures can get down to really, when we were there, which was the summer season in Antarctica, where there's 24 hours of sunlight, the temperatures really got down to a low of probably minus 40 or minus 50 degrees. And actually, you know, I think some places in the United States started to experience those kinds of temperatures with wind chill not too long ago in January. But on average, I'd say the temperature was probably minus 20 or so. And we had to make sure that we never had any skin exposed when we're outside or outside of the tent. So it's a hostile place, but one that, above all, is overwhelmingly beautiful and holds a lot of potential for very important research that can be done. And some of the most important information that has come out in terms of climate research and understanding past climates has come out of the really, really long ice cores, the really long ice cores coming out of Antarctica, those that go back 400,000, 800,000 years, maybe over a million years. So it's an incredibly important place, one that is undergoing a lot of change, but a very beautiful one.
You've been to the North Pole as well. How is it different than the North Pole in your experience?
Well, the first thing the first biggest difference about Antarctica and the Arctic, or between the two places, is that Antarctica is a continent with an ice sheet on top, and the Arctic is an ocean surrounded by continents. And so when we were at the North Pole, I was standing on maybe a couple meters of sea ice and several miles of water beneath my feet. And so that's really the most fundamental difference, because it drives all the other differences, which is that at the South Pole or in Antarctica, you can get crevasses, and you can't get those in the Arctic. Instead, the most similar or the sort of analogous feature would be open water, the big cracks between two plates of sea ice where there's a big section of open water, and those are very frequent, they're very normal, but they are sort of everywhere. And then there's also in the Arctic Ocean, there are very large features called pressure ridges, which are effectively just fields or ridges of rubble ice, which make it very difficult to travel. And it's sort of one of the main reasons, in addition to open water, that you can't really drive over Arctic sea ice, even if you had a vehicle capable of transforming into a boat as well.
Well, it's those very differences that make so many of the stories coming out of the polar region the ones that we seem to pay the most attention to, not just because it's slightly closer to us in the Northern Hemisphere, but also just because there is all this shifting terrain in a way. What do the changes of climate change mean in Antarctica? What do you see there that is shifting, that is changing on a rapid basis now because of climate change?
Well, I think by nature, the Arctic Ocean is a lot easier to communicate when it comes to change. People tend to latch on to how the Arctic is changing because it's much easier conceptually, which is that the Arctic sea ice is diminishing in extent and volume, which means you can visualize the shrinking ice cap. In Antarctica, it's not quite the same. You don't get this rapid diminishing of sea ice. In fact, the parts of the ice sheet on top of the continent are getting a little bit colder. But one of the most important contributions to the impacts of climate change of the Antarctic continent is the rapid flow of ice into the sea. And I am not an expert in this area, but one of the more important ways that Antarctica contributes to the impacts of climate change is that when you get warmer water or warm water upwelling from deep in the ocean currents around Antarctica, at the interaction of the ice shelf or ice sheet or sorry the ice shelf with the continent, you end up warming and creating a layer of sort of lubricating water between the base continent and the ice sheet on top of it, with just melting a very very thin layer, and that doesn't physically melt the whole ice sheet, but it does make movement towards the sea a lot faster. So you get glaciers that are flowing a lot faster now. And one example is the Pine Island Glacier, which on its own is contributing over the next 20 or so years is going to contribute a measurable amount of sea level change just by itself, this one glacier in Antarctica, which is a couple hundred kilometers from the start point of our expedition. And there are parts of Antarctica that are warming faster than the others. And, of course, it's because it's such a big continent, not everything is uniform, and there are many different ways that the Antarctic continent is being impacted. But one of the ways that Antarctica contributes to the reason why people living in New York or another coastal city should care about this is that it contributes to global sea level rise.
Well, Parker Liotot, I wish you continued success on your research, and congratulations on this expedition, and hopefully you'll get a chance to go back there and do some more work. It's a fascinating project, and I appreciate you joining us here on Where We Live.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Coming up, our conversation about climate change continues. We'll get an update on some of the latest reports and take a closer look at the factors shaping national and international attitude toward global warming and climate change. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about climate change. A recent Gallup poll found that most Americans aren't really all that concerned about climate issues. We want to find out why. What's driving the American attitudes toward global warming? How does it compare to attitudes on an international scale? We'll also be looking at some of the latest research. We want you to join us at 860-275-7266. We will get to your calls in just a moment. But first, we want to welcome in some regular guests who help us talk about this issue and think about climate change. Gary Yeo is Huffington Foundation Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies at Wesleyan University in Middletown. He joins us by phone today. Gary, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Anthony Leiserwitz is here. He's director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. He joins us from the Yale University Studios in New Haven. Anthony, welcome back to our show.
Hi, John. Great to be with you.
First, Gary Yeo, we see in the New York Times today that the American Association for the Advancement of Science will release a new report with more scary language about the realities of climate change and its impacts. I'm wondering if you can tell us, Gary, is there any new science or new scientific consensus on climate change since the last time we spoke?
There is growing support for stronger conclusions. There will be a blizzard of reports about climate change coming out, actually starting late last year with Working Group 1 of the IPCC, but Working Group 2 is coming out, Working Group 3 is coming out before May. The National Climate Assessment from the administration is due out no earlier than April 28th, but probably not much later than that. Then there's also a group called Risky Business that ex-Mayor Bloomberg put together, has some really heavy hitters like Hank Paulson and Robert Rubin and Olympia Snow and George Shultz. And they are worried about vulnerability of the financial sector to climate change, and they're expecting a report out. The participation of that committee in an ongoing outreach program starting in around July.
In this blizzard of reports and studies that are coming out, essentially it sounds like you're saying, Gary, there's support for stronger conclusions, but does this mean something new to get out to the public? Because as we're going to talk to Anthony about in just a moment, it seems as though the public interest, at least in America, in this issue is waning. Is there some big new takeaway that might get people thinking about climate change again?
Well, there's a new way of thinking about it, which is in terms of risk, which is likelihood and consequence, which allows people to talk seriously about the things that Parker were talking about, the change in the intensity and frequency of extreme weather events, floods, heavy rainstorms. In the winter, it shows up as snow because it's cold in North America in the wintertime. Fires, droughts, a variety of things like that across the United States, and we've already been experiencing that. So part of the new science is serious work on our confidence in what we've detected in terms of those impacts on a local and regional scale, and the degree to which we can attribute that to climate change and then anthropogenic sources of the human emissions of greenhouse gases that cause climate change. And it's adding to a preponderance of evidence that still 98% of the scientists who study climate for their avocation believe that the climate, it's unequivocal that the planet is warmed. It's unequivocal that the old climate normal is broken, and there's extraordinarily high confidence that humans have played a significant role in making that happen.
So, Anthony, before we get to some of our phone calls, and a lot of people want to join our conversation, let's try to figure this out a bit. We've talked about this in the show before. We have Gary Yeo saying that there's more evidence coming out all the time, new ways of thinking about it, including economics and risk, things that might hit people's pocketbooks. 98% of the scientists of the world say this is something that's happening and humans are causing it, but yet when you study it at Yale or Gallup does a study, it seems as though Americans either don't believe in climate change or they just don't care that much. What gives?
Yeah, well, so, you know, this is not a simple thing. This is multiple things going on. So let's just note that there's at least three major things here in the United States. First of all, let's not forget that the past couple of years we've undergone a major economic crisis and recession and unemployment, you know, things that are very much closer to home and on the top of people's priorities. And so climate and a lot of other issues just got pushed down the priority list. Secondly, though, what's not as well understood, and this actually goes back to Parker's point, that we just don't talk about this issue. And that includes in the media, with the great obvious exception of your program, John. But more broadly, in the media, we just don't talk about this issue that much. We've done media analyses and show that, you know, it can be as low as 0.1% of total media coverage even mentions the words climate change. So while the media doesn't tell us what to think, it's very clear that the media helps us understand what is important to talk about. And when the media doesn't report it, it just seems to fade away well into the background compared to the other issues that we're debating. But the third thing that we also have to recognize, and this is particularly here true in the United States, is the politicization of this issue. That unfortunately, this issue has become a football between Democrats and Republicans, and far too many people basically treat it as a partisan litmus test. In other words, if Al Gore is talking about climate change, and I don't like Al Gore at all, then I'm very inclined to say that I don't believe anything he has to say. So this partisanship dimension, this framing of it as a political struggle, means that it gets stuck in the same dysfunctionality of our broader politics and what we see in Congress today.
And it also gets stuck in some of the simplistic ways we like to do the news in America, Tony. So, for instance, this last winter, especially here in the Northeast and across much of the Midwest, well, it was cold. It was icy. There was a lot of snow. We're dealing with something called the polar vortex, and may have you guys talk about why that was happening in just a moment. But the way we thought about it, the way we talked about it was, well, there can't really be climate change or global warming happening. See how cold it is? And that seems to have driven a lot of the conversation about climate over the course of this winter.
That's right. And that's because in many cases, people, of course, were intensely local. We pay attention to what's happening in our immediate vicinity, and we then extrapolate from there. But the fact is, even during the worst of the polar vortex, you could see that only 2% of the world's surface here in the United States was experiencing that kind of cold. When you look at the whole Earth, the rest of the planet almost entirely was much warmer than normal. So you can't take even an area like, you know, everywhere east of the Mississippi and suddenly extrapolate from that to this is what's going on at the global scale. There is a reason why we call it global warming. So, you know, that's part of the problem is that we get stuck looking at the trees that we have trouble stepping back and looking at the whole forest.
There's also, John, new science. That problem was not that the polar vortex suddenly appeared. It's that it moved location. And a significant part of it broke off and went down to Chicago for a visit. There's new science that suggests that the same flows of atmosphere and warm atmosphere that created the intensity of the cyclone that went across Indonesia and the really warm waters off of Indonesia that amplified that cyclone created stronger winds that pushed up through the Arctic from that side of the world. And if you push over the Arctic from that side of the world and push weather systems past the Arctic, where do you go? You go to Chicago. So there's actually reason to believe that even the manifestation of that change in local weather and regional weather had something to do with very global systems that have something to do with anthropogenic sources of climate change.
We're talking about climate change in the program today, and we're speaking with Gary Yeo from Wesleyan University and Anthony Leiserwitz from Yale University. And we're going to take some of your phone calls now. Adam is calling from West Hartford. Hi there, Adam. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Good morning. I have a question for either of your guests. My question is, do either of you know if climate change is part of the science curriculum at any level in grades K through 12? Because my thinking is that it might take kids learning about it at a young age and having the science hammered home to them from a young age before, as a nation, we really start to believe it. I mean, my brother is in his 30s. He's a bright guy, very smart, very well-read, doesn't believe it, doesn't believe in climate change. And all I can think is, maybe this is something that needs to be hammered home from a young age before we, as a nation, we really start to believe it.
Adam, thank you very much for the question. Anthony, what do we know about that? How is it being taught? And do you think that attitudes maybe amongst the very young are slightly different around this?
Yeah. Okay. So great question, Adam. So it turns out that there is new national science standards in which climate change is now a key part. So in terms of what the nation as a whole is saying, these are important scientific facts among all the other kinds of scientific facts that we're asking young people to learn. Climate change should be part of that. But the other thing to remember about the United States is that school policies and curriculum are often set at the state and local levels. And so we're seeing now that there's a very patchy kind of teaching of climate change around the country. In fact, I think even just a day or two ago, the governor of Wyoming is going to veto his state's curriculum, science curriculum standards, in part because it's going to be teaching climate change. So you see these kinds of local debates emerging. But again, there is this national effort to say, look, these are some of the core concepts of earth science that we hope every American learns in school.
There are also a couple of foundations that are really trying to work to create curricula and advocate them, go to professional meetings of educational society. One is called Green Educational Foundation. And their perspective is to bring rigorous science into a series of contexts so that it can be inserted in a variety of different modules in the curriculum that already exists, rather than tell teachers that they have to throw something away and do something else. You can learn mathematics by learning climate change. You can learn science by learning climate change. You can learn how to read literature by thinking about the manifestations of climate change and how it affects human societies and ecosystems. So there are people that are working on that. It's going slowly, but and Tony's absolutely right. I mean, the opposition comes from local and state agencies and as high as governors, and so it's not an easy fight, but there are people fighting that fight.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Lori is calling from New Haven. Hi, Lori. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having this conversation. I wanted to call in because one thing that's been touched upon by all the speakers and also the gentleman who just called in is the need for the conversation about climate change. And my daughter, Sean, is one of 65 folks marching. They kicked off this past March 1st in Wilmington, which is the port of Los Angeles. And they're marching from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. over the next 8 months. To have these conversations, to go in and have teach-ins and communities. They actually have one person who's going ahead and doing K through 5 educational programs in schools that want to participate. And their goal is to get to Washington, D.C. this November 1st, right before the election, to keep raising awareness about climate change and what each of us can do in order to address this. So check out climatemarch.org.
Glory, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Hartford. Hi, Mary.
Hi. So I just want to say the news coverage of the Antarctic expeditions and the filibusters in Washington are fascinating, yet we desperately need news coverage of local municipal action, investments, and planning events that can make communities sustainable. And let's learn from each other. If we knew more about what Northampton was doing, what Mayor Bloomberg is doing, what Mayor Nutter in Philadelphia is doing to help their cities by using their taxpayer money to prepare for climate change, that would be great. A lot of times we see a lot of community activities, gazebos or things that are built that are make people happy, but is that really preparing, is that our tax dollars in the Hartford metro area really preparing us for the future? And that's really where most of the changes in climate adaptation and mitigation are happening at the municipal level, but we're not really getting the coverage of that here.
Mary, thank you very much for your phone call. And Gary, I'll ask you about this. This question of adaptation is a very important one as we try to raise awareness about what scientists say is happening at the global level. It does seem to take a little bit to get through people's heads, but when you have conversations about, you know, my shoreline could be flooded soon, or this serious storm could wreak havoc in my community, and the ways we need to prepare for it, it does tend to change the conversation just a little bit. How do you think that we're moving, Gary, toward adaptation to the changes that are happening?
We're doing it one step at a time, but it isn't all necessarily public money. The state of Connecticut under Dan Estee, when he was commissioner, created a program that helps people underwrite insurance for floods along coastlines and rivers and things like that if they undertake certain adaptations. And it helps underwrite the adaptations as a loan. You pay the money back, but the internal rate of return and reduce insurance premiums is sufficient that you actually make money doing this. The Nature Conservancy has a group of people that are helping coastal towns from Greenwich through Norwich prepare and plan and think about what development strategies need to be to try to respond. But I have to say that sort of the contrarian view that makes people less convinced that the climate is in fact changing, it's not only dangerous, it's almost irresponsible, because it gives people an excuse not to prepare for these things. Yesterday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, George Will wrote, "Somebody who is determined to disbelieve something can manage to disregard an Everest of evidence for it." He wasn't talking about his disbelief of climate change and ignoring the mountain of evidence that supports that. He was talking about Obama and inequality and things like that. But he goes on every month on his op-ed, and at least three or four times a year on national TV. He's not the only one, but he's on Sunday morning, and rails against climate and the plateau of the warming and things like that, and gives people the impression that the debate is not over, but that in fact the only place it looks like a 50-50 debate in the literature is in the Federal Register.
I'm wondering, Anthony, if you found in your study of America and the different attitudes toward this, if it really is localized in a sense. I know that you've done some study in places like Texas. You mentioned, you know, Wyoming earlier. Are we really one country when it comes to climate belief or disbelief, or are we split into a variety of different places that have a little bit to do with sort of who we are and where we live in this country?
So, great question. So, first of all, I mean, in our work, we've identified what we call global warming six Americas, six very different parts of the public that each respond to this issue in very different ways. The first is a group we call the alarmed, that's 16% of Americans, who are very concerned about this issue, and they want to take action, but they really want to know, what can I do? What can we do? And we haven't done a good enough job of helping them understand those solutions. Then a group we call the concerned, that's about 27%, and they are convinced that it's happening in human cause, but they tend to still think of it as distant, that the impacts won't be felt for a generation or more, or that it's about polar bears or small island countries, not the United States, not my state, not my community. It's not local. Then a group we call the cautious, about a quarter of the public, and they're still kind of on the fence, still making up their mind. Is it real or not? Is it human or natural? Then a small group we call the disengaged, about 5%, who have heard of global warming but don't know anything about it. So really it's basic awareness that's their primary barrier. Then a group we call the doubtful, it's about 12%. And these are people who don't think it's really happening, but if it is, it's just natural cycles, nothing we did anything had anything to do with, nothing we can do anything about, so they don't pay that much attention. And then last but not least is that group that we call the dismissive. 15% of Americans who are convinced it's not happening and not human-caused, and many of them are conspiracy theorists. They say it's a hoax, scientists making up data, a UN plot to take away American sovereignty, and so on and so forth. Now, they're only 15%, but as Gary was just saying, they're a very loud 15%. There are 15% that are well represented in editorial pages and in Congress, and so it's easy to come away with the misimpression that that's half or more of the country. It's not.
I laugh at the idea of the UN plot to take over anything. I sometimes wonder if the UN could plot to take over my local 7-Eleven successfully. But well, let's just quickly go to a few more phone calls here at 860-275-7266. As I know, a lot of people want to join our conversation as we have this conversation about climate change and attitudes toward it. Brett is in Newington. Hi, Brett.
Hi. Thank you very much for having this conversation and having me a part of it. I think education is definitely key. Start them off young and in volume being numbers, but that takes a generation. There is another effective way of teaching people. Now, side note, there could be a global warming trend that has nothing to do with what we are contributing. However, our contribution does not make it worse does not make it less obvious. It's more obvious. Okay, I'm getting a little bit off track. Here's the test to make believers out of those who are in doubt or do not believe. If you have a garage, go in the garage, start your car, let it run for 5 minutes, less if you already notice a difference in whatever time you're in there. If you do not notice a difference or still doubt it, do more research and stay there a little bit longer.
Well, Brett, I'll just say, first of all, that's probably a really bad idea for people to start up their car inside. I take your point. I understand what you're saying, but I will probably just throw out a note there. It's probably not the thing for people to do. I do appreciate your call. Let's before we go to Jack in Hamden, Gary, you're just listening to our caller here. Okay. Very quickly, and this is from a non-scientific standpoint. I know that you've got to talk about climate change to a lot of your peers all the time, but you also have to talk to the public a lot. Make the case that Brett is trying to make. Make a case to someone at a cocktail party about why they should be paying more attention.
Well, this is actually something that I've thought of recently. The question is, why do you believe that this extra human activity over the last century has been doing anything? There's been all of this variability before. Maybe it's just that sort of variability. So I think about living along a river, and every spring it floods because of the snow melt up in the mountains. And everybody gets used to that. But then along comes climate change, and on top of this snow melt, there are these extreme rain events. That exacerbate the flooding and make it larger and more damaging. The argument that the rain didn't cause the extra damage is the same thing as saying humans haven't caused any of this extra variability in the climate system because it's always happened. And nobody is saying that humans are creating all of the climate variability, and nobody is saying that any one particular extreme precipitation or extreme weather event was caused by climate change. It's the preponderance of evidence and the extra pace at which the climate is changing that's causing the change in the intensity and frequency. And like I said before, it therefore becomes extraordinarily dangerous not to take into account as you make plans for the future in terms of development or what sort of roof you put on your house or whatever, the notion that the last 30 years of climate that you've experienced are not a good indicator of the next 30 years of climate.
Let's go to Jack in Hamden quickly. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, gentlemen, for having me on.
Yeah.
Just some comments, please. A couple of 400-pound gorillas in the room. Airliners are chewing up the ozone layer. You got two cycle engines, diesel engines, and everything else, cow emissions, that are chewing it up down here. Let's accept the planet we've made. This planet is a piece of coal in the universe for the human existence to mine. We're going to use it up. Let's face it. Let's get up there. That means more money for NASA and less for the Department of Defense. And certainly education. STEM, No Child Left Behind, bunch of catchphrases and don't do anything.
Well, Jack, first of all, thank you very much for your phone call. Anthony Leiserwitz, so Jack and a lot of our callers, I mean, they're skipping past this. They're very worried. Jack wants to go to space. He's so concerned about the status of the planet right now. What do you say to Jack and some of the other people who are expressing their concerns about how Americans view this right now?
Well, I mean, I actually want to come back to this prior discussion about local, because this is, I think, really, really important. And it's actually something that you, of course, devoted your entire show to. And that is, this is about understanding this issue from the standpoint of where we live, literally. Unfortunately, most of the scientific community and those that have talked about global climate change have always talked about it in these global terms. We started by trying to convince people that you need to take this issue seriously because it's happening globally. But in the end, most of us live very local lives. We care deeply, passionately about the places we live and where we grew up and where we work and where we raise our families and so on. That's where we get our news and information about. That's what we care about. And so one of the best ways to start this conversation about climate change is to talk about how are our communities vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. And in my experience working with local communities, when you start having that conversation and you start saying, well, okay, what would we need to do to become more resilient to the impacts of climate change where we live? People begin to see, oh, okay, well, there are certain things that we can do to make ourselves more resilient to the impacts we're already experiencing, and we all know here in Connecticut how vulnerable we can be. But what would that be like, and how would we have to prepare for another degree, or 2 degrees, or 3 degrees, or 4 degrees warmer globally than what we have today? And what I find is that many people, as you walk them through that process, suddenly get really, really interested in reducing the problem in the first place and recognizing that we can't just simply adapt our way out of it. So I think this whole discussion of starting local and then moving to the global is actually a far more engaging way to make people or help people understand why this matters to us.
Anthony Leiserwitz is director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. We're going to have links on WNPR.org to some of the work that he's done on this issue. Anthony, as always, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
Thanks also to Gary Yeo, who's Huffington Foundation Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies at Wesleyan University. Good to talk to you again, Gary.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, and good to hear your voice, Tony.
Now, when we come back, we're going to tackle another issue that we've been talking about a lot on the show. It's sexual assault on college campuses, and we're going to get a legislative update on that coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, will be down in New Haven, where special elections have created a political game of musical chairs recently. Our panel of reporters will catch you up on all the week's news from the Elm City and beyond. You can join us, as always, at WNPR.org. Now, last week on Where We Live, we held a conversation about campus sexual assault. During our program, we discussed a bill being considered by Connecticut lawmakers to address some of the management practices schools employ when dealing with issues of assault. Here's Jillian Gilchrist on Where We Live talking about that bill, House Bill 5029.
What this bill will do is expands on proactive 2012 legislation to include some best practices, including ongoing prevention, education, and awareness for all students and employees, with an emphasis on bystander intervention.
Well, a lot has happened since that program last week. That bill, House Bill 5029, was recently voted out of the Higher Education Committee. Here to talk about it is State Representative Roberta Willis. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, John. Thank you for having me on.
So maybe you can give us a little update. What's happened with this bill since we last talked?
Well, since you last talked, it was passed unanimously out of the Higher Education Committee last week. So now it'll go to the floor of the House.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about this legislation and what you hope it's going to do.
What I hope it's going to do is it's going to make colleges responsible for prevention of sexual assault on college campuses. The emphasis on this bill really is more on prevention. It's more prescriptive. When we did the bill in 2012, the focus really was on reporting sexual assaults, to ensure that that was happening, to ensure that schools had policies and programs. But this is going well beyond that. It's going to really structuring and requiring them to have ongoing campus awareness and programs, not just freshman orientation where they tell you a little bit that you don't remember, most students don't recall, being told about some of the things to watch for and what services were available. This time we're saying it needs to be ongoing. You need to really do climate change.
Yeah, at the school level. Well, and one of the things I want to ask you about, though, and this is something that came up over and over again, is so much of everything that schools do, even schools that are trying very hard, is targeted at young women. Here's how to protect yourself. Here's the things not to do. Here's the services are available when, in the almost likelihood now, that you may experience this because so many young women do. What can we do to influence and do a climate change around the young men on campus?
Well, what we're trying to do in this bill, and we've actually described it, is bystander intervention. And that's really our best hope, I think, for reducing sexual violence. Men need to be a part of the conversation about sexual assault. And I'm not sure that that has really happened. It really has focused so much around women blaming the victim. You know, she was drinking, she was at a party that maybe she shouldn't have been at, maybe she was wearing provocative clothing. And we need to get away from that. We need to move to make everyone on colleges more aware. And with bystander intervention, you're saying, and a lot of schools are already moving in this direction, University of Massachusetts at Amherst is, you know, basically just don't stand there, do something. If you see something happening. And we did that in this country with Don't Drink and Drive. Friends don't let friends drink and drive. And we all now have, as part of our lexicon, the designated driver, you know? And 10 years ago, people didn't ask those questions before you went drinking.
In some ways, it seems, and we just have about a minute and a half left here, but it seems as though a lot of things have been changing, at least up at the Capitol, in terms of how much people are paying attention to this because of what happened at the University of Connecticut. I guess I'm wondering if you can just tell us from the insider's point of view how the conversations have changed at the Capitol around this bill and around sexual assault on college campuses since the revelations at UConn.
Well, we wouldn't be having this conversation today if it wasn't for the young women that came forward at UConn. And I think, although we did it in the past, it really didn't get on people's radar screens as it should be. And as I said before, we really focused on policies and procedures. And this time we're looking at prevention, but we're also looking at the emphasis on what we can do in terms of helping these women who've come forward with the trauma they've undergone. One of the things that really hits you when you're looking at these different cases is how these women were handled afterwards. They weren't treated appropriately. They were mishandled either by the way the campus security responded to them or the way the information was presented to them. They weren't clearly given their options. And that's where this bill hopes to get at, that there's more training on campuses for people who are actually going to be providing the services. And people need to be more aware of that. And so we've, you know, established that in this legislation that campus security need to be trained. They need to respond, provide services that are non-judgmental and are compassionate.
And again, this is House Bill 5029. It's part of a new look at sexual assault on college campuses. State Representative Roberta Willis, House Chair of the Higher Education Committee, joined us to talk a bit about it. Thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you can look for more of our coverage on this issue at WNPR.org. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.